Hello and welcome to Inside Briefing, a podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Bronwyn Maddox. The great unlockdown has been delayed, but the IFG podcast is bang on time. So fire up the barbie, get feasting on the Tim Tams. The UK is set to sign a trade agreement with Australia. It's being heralded as a triumph for global Britain, but is the deal with our friends down under really something to crow about? We will talk to the IFG's trade expert to find out more. And from global Britain to the grandly titled Great British Railways, government plans are afoot, or on track perhaps, to overhaul Britain's rail network. So will they work? Who's in charge? Are delays inevitable? We'll take a look. And while we're on grand titles, how about this one? The Declaration on Government Reform. That's the name of Michael Gove's new paper, setting out his vision, another one, for overhauling the way the civil service works and the way it works with ministers. And the IFG is, as you'd expect, taking a very close interest. So we'll see what the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, another title, is up to and whether it's a good thing. I've got a terrific top IFG trio in the virtual studio today. Senior Fellow and number 10 veteran, Jill Rutter. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Bronwyn.
Very good to have you with us. Matthew Gill, our newest Senior Fellow and the author of our new report on the rail reforms, is with us as well. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Bronwyn.
Great to have you. And joining us all the way from Australia again is our senior researcher, Sarah Nixon. Hi, Sarah. How's life?
It's good, thanks, Bronwyn. A little drizzly and cold, unfortunately.
Well, there's so many times you've beaten us to it. We're not going to cry over that one. Let's start with Australia, as Liz Truss might well have argued in the cabinet over the last few months. And the Trade Secretary has clearly won over the doubts of her ministerial colleagues because a trade deal with Australia has been secured. But what's in it? What difference will it make? And is this a glorious moment for global Britain? For this, we're bringing in one more IFG expert, our associate James Kane, who looks at all things to do with trade for us. Hi, James.
Hello, Bronwyn.
Very good to have you with us. So let me ask you first, should we be congratulating Liz Truss?
Yes, I think so. It is the first new trade agreement that the UK has ever done. We've now got about 40 trade agreements in place, but they're all copies of ones that we already had as part of the EU. So the Australia deal is the first completely new trade agreement, which is in itself a thing to be proud of, and something that the IFG recommended 4 years ago when we suggested that she should start with Australia.
How much do we actually know about this deal?
We've got a bit more over the last couple of days. Strangely, the Australian government seems to have been a lot more transparent than the UK government has been so far. So we've got a pretty full list of the high-level commitments that they've made over the last few days. And on the whole, it looks like a fairly standard trade agreement in most respects. It covers all the subjects that you would expect. And so we don't see much of the detail on some of the technical issues like rules of origin. And those are the areas where negotiations will probably still continue over the next few weeks, even after this agreement in principle.
So will British shoppers be really pleased by this or appalled that some things are going to be more expensive?
They probably won't see much of a difference, to be honest. At the moment, the tariffs that Australian goods pay when they come into the UK amount to somewhere around £30 or £40 million a year. So if those get taken away, then that's a saving, doing some quick arithmetic, of about 70 pence per person per year, which... I mean, you might notice it in your shopping basket, but you probably won't. And in any case, the supermarkets and other people along the distribution chain will probably take it anyway.
Very neatly put. And this is a point you've been making on Twitter, I think, that actually people can overestimate what trade deals can actually do. But what about British farmers who've been not entirely relaxed about this?
No, they will be unhappy about this deal. It is a very good deal for Australian farming. It's the first trade agreement that Australia has ever signed with a kind of northern food importing country like the UK or the EU or the US or Japan that provides for completely free trade in agricultural products. And that's problematic for British farmers because the UK's prices for some key products like beef and sheep meat are rather higher than those in the rest of the world, and so they could see themselves undercut.
Matthew, drawing on your background in the Treasury and in economics, what do you make of it?
Well, I think people will be pleased that it's sort of over the line, at least in principle. It's quite, as James mentioned, it's a fairly narrow deal, and So the thing you might be most concerned about is what precedent this sets for future deals, but the scope of this is not enormous in that respect. The other thing that I think is interesting about it is that there's been some speculation that it might make it easier for us to negotiate a place in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would be a much wider trade deal, including places like Japan, Canada, Singapore, Mexico. And there's even speculation about whether the US or even China might join that in the longer term. So this could be a bridge in that direction. But I think that's a negotiation that we could probably have participated in anyway. So I think, you know, it's good news. People will be relieved that it's done. But it's not earth shattering.
Okay, very much in agreement with James. Jill, you spent a great deal of time writing about Brexit, about trade, and about Australia. Was it smart to start with Australia?
Yes, I mean, as James said in our report that we did at IFG 4 years ago now, taking back control of trade policy, we suggested that actually as unpracticed negotiators, it was sensible to start with friendly and quite distant countries, and both Australia and New Zealand, where there may be a trade deal in the works as well, about to be unveiled imminently, both fall into that category. You know, it does seem to be a very good deal for Australia. As James said, their offensive interest in trade talk is always about getting agricultural access, and the UK does seem to have conceded that. And I think, I don't know whether James agrees, that one of the sort of slight worries is not that there'll be a huge flood of Australian exports to the UK, because actually Australia does very well in the Asian markets, but it sort of offers the UK as a potential backup market if for some reason there's disruption in Asia, and that might worry farmers when they, you know, protections are being phased out as far as we can see. I think the really interesting thing in this, though, is what's the UK got out of it? You could say UK consumers are the winners from access to Australian beef. We always focus on producer interest rather than consumer interest. But as James said, they might be hard-pressed to notice the benefits in their shopping basket. But what's the UK got out of it? We've told that the UK strategy from the start was going to be sort of less protections on agriculture than the EU, but opening up markets for UK services. Be really interested if James has any view on that. And I think the other interesting thing is that this deal features enhanced mobility provisions, really annoyingly making it easier for people under 35, that doesn't include me, to go on a working holiday in either direction. Might help fill some of the au pair shortages we're seeing here as a result of Brexit. A bit of squeaking, I think, from Australian farmers that the sort of forced labour on Australian farms, I don't really mean forced labour, but the fact you have to do a bit of time in a rural community if you want to extend your working holiday in Australia beyond a year, that condition now goes. But I think it's really interesting, I think, whether that sets a precedent for future trade deals, and whether when the UK tries to secure its deal with India, where mobility has always been a big requirement, whether the Indians throw back those provisions with Australia back in its face. And quite a lot of people are, of course, comparing that with a very restrictive approach to mobility that the UK adopted in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement with the EU.
Very interesting about how that links, as you said, with mobility, with migration, with visas and so on. Sarah, how has this been greeted in Australia? Delight? No, we've had triumphalism even here.
Look, I'd say the reaction is fairly muted, but welcome. So I don't think anyone thinks that this trade deal is going to be revolutionary for Australia. That said, the agricultural industry have obviously welcomed the phasing out of tariffs and the opportunity to diversify their export markets, particularly away from China, which is a bit of a trouble spot at the moment for Australia. But at the same time, all of those industry leaders have said that their focus is likely to remain on Asian markets. I think, interestingly, though, some people, and particularly people of an older generation, have not people of my generation, disclosure, I'm a millennial, but I think people that remember the UK joining the EU's predecessor have expressed a sense of this trade deal righting what they call an historic wrong. And actually, the trade minister used those exact words. There's a sense among, you know, people that remember that time of the UK almost having abandoned Australia by putting up trade barriers when it joined the EU's predecessor. So, you know, there's been expressed a sense that things have come full circle. But at the same time, the world has moved on. Australia has moved on. The composition of our export markets have drastically changed since that time. So that's probably much more in terms of symbolism than substance. Don't expect your roads to be paved with Tim Tams anytime soon.
And just for our listeners, just let us know what a Tim Tam is and why people might want the one.
So apologies in advance, because I think I might be able to say the most controversial thing that might have ever been said on an IFG podcast. Because in a nutshell, Tim Tams are the superior form of penguin biscuits. IFG has conducted extensive but as yet unpublished research on their respective merits, and I have to say the British cousin was found wanting on this occasion. As to whether you're going to be flooded with Tim Tam imports as a result of this deal, I think wait and see. I think one interesting thing, and this goes to demonstrate that, you know, this trade deal is not going to necessarily revolutionise anything. When you look at the cost of the Tim Tams in Australian supermarkets, about £2. Where I've been able to find Tim Tams in the UK, you're looking more at like £4.50, £5. That's about that's over 100% markup. Tariff on Tim Tams is only about 8 or 9%. So clearly there's a big gap between that 8 or 9% and over 100%. And I think it just goes to show that, yes, there will be benefits from bringing down the trade barriers and tariffs, but it's not necessarily going to be enough that consumers necessarily notice it.
Well, thank you for that wonderful explanation. I can see us starting a Tim Tam index and a chart coming on. James, perhaps you could wrap this up for us and just say what you think Liz Truss might take from this whole negotiation for future trade deals and which ones are coming down the line. Jill's already referred to India.
I think what you can take from it is that if you're interested in doing trade deals with big agricultural exporters like Australia or New Zealand, the US, the South American countries, then you can get quite a lot of good mileage from being the only big food importer in the world to be prepared to liberalise your markets. Now, in the past, we've said that one of the government's problems on trade has been that it doesn't have a clear strategy. But actually, if that is the strategy that you want to pursue, effectively giving better access for farming in return for trade deals, that is a viable approach. It might not do that much for the economy. The government under Theresa May did some analysis that found that even if you did trade deals with every other country in the G20, including the US, you'd still only see a GDP gain of about 0.4%, which is nowhere near compensating for the reduction in GDP that the same government analysis suggests the model of relationship they've chosen with the EU will produce. But if what you want is trade deals, then I think what this says is that giving access for meat and other agricultural products is a way forward.
All right. So good for most people, even if not enough to compensate for leaving the EU, possibly bad for some farmers. I'm not going to embed an ad for Jeremy Clarkson's farming program on this, but I've had it thrust on me recently. But they will have a lot to say about it. James, thank you for that. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's travel from the Department for International Trade to the Department for Transport, because Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, has been busy thinking up plans to reform Britain's rail networks. And he's published a plan called Great British Railways. We set Matthew the task of reading it, reviewing it, and writing a short paper very quickly on whether that plan will work. Matthew, in a nutshell, what is he trying to do?
Well, I think the main thing he's trying to achieve is simplification. To explain that, I'll have to give you a very brief description of the current situation, which people often call the money go round, where passengers pay fares to train operating companies to travel on the train. Those companies pay fees to the Department of Transport, and they pay charges to Network Rail. The Department for Transport subsidises the train operating companies and gives a grant to Network Rail, and Network Rail compensates the train operating companies for any problems on the network. Now, that obviously is quite complicated and creates contractual dispute and interface at every stage of that process. So the idea is to simplify that such that fares from passengers will go directly to Great British Railways, the new body, that body will also receive grants from the Department for Transport, and it will pay fees to train operators to run the trains. So it should be a simpler process. That means there's a sort of reduced role for the actual operating companies running the trains. They're just operating the companies rather than trying to build a franchise and be involved in longer term infrastructure work as well. And it should mean also that there's a more nationally consistent offer for the passenger. So ticketing will be consistent. Timetabling will be managed much more centrally. And so people should see a more streamlined and smooth kind of interface with which to deal with the national rail network. So that's the intention of it.
I'm glad you put in that point about passengers, because the simplification of the ticketing is something that's been a real bugbear. Any sense of what it's going to do to prices of tickets?
Well, I don't think you can expect prices for tickets to come down. There was some talk in the consultation about season tickets for people commuting into the office 2 or 3 days a week, which would be somewhat cheaper than buying a 5 day a week season ticket. So really accounting for new working patterns post COVID. But certainly the walk up fares are likely to continue to rise at roughly the rate that they have done previously. I think the emphasis will rather be on looking at the costs in the system. And I think one of the unanswered questions is actually how costs are going to be reduced and what the role of the passenger service operators, which is the new name for the train operating companies, is likely to be in that. But I don't expect a fare reduction anytime soon.
All right, because the rail overall, it's in financial trouble, isn't it? I mean, the passenger numbers have been dropping enormously during the pandemic, and companies across the system have found it hard to make consistent returns.
Absolutely, and I think the contract that will be written with the new passenger service operators will still be trying to incentivize them to increase demand on the railways, but clearly the extent to which that's successful is going to depend a lot on the development of the pandemic and working patterns going forward. It may be that people just travel less, and that may make the system more expensive to maintain in its current form.
And you pointed out some big gaps in what Grant Shapps has announced. Not a lot of detail about the GBR's remit, what freedom it has in its operation, how it's going to be governed, how we get there from here. In your view, these are big gaps?
I think they're quite significant. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, with any organisational reform like this, there'll be way more detail under the bonnet to be worked through than they could put in the initial document. But there is indeed a lot in here. And I think the transition is particularly important, because not only have we got to design a system which works in a more streamlined manner going forward, but we've got to get from here to there. And there's a real importance of maintaining public confidence in the brand of Great British Railways during that transition, because in a way, it doesn't matter how good the steady state is. If people lose confidence in that brand over the next couple of years while we're trying to bring current contracts to an end, there's a suggestion there'll be 2-year bridging contracts to go from the current system to the new system. And if that is sort of chaotic or seems ill-coordinated, then the brand will be tarnished, and it will be an uphill struggle to maintain public confidence in reforms after that.
Jill, what do you make of all this? You were in government for a previous round of rail reforms and the rounds that followed. Is this patching up mistakes of the past?
I think you could say that. I mean, rail, I was actually number 10 when I joined the number 10 policy unit, had already been made to privatise rail. And it was almost like devaluation in the Wilson government, that rail privatisation was the word that nobody was allowed to mention. I remember one of my colleagues in the policy unit on his first day saying to the then head of the policy unit, "This rail privatisation is never going to work, is it?" And he was told that that was extremely unhelpful, and could he never mention that, particularly in front of the Prime Minister. So I think it's always been one of the most troubled privatisations. A lot of people are still very unconvinced that it is better. I mean, one of the big reasons for privatisation was to generate much more investment than you ever got when you basically had to negotiate that in successive spending rounds, give more certainty on that. And I think we have seen more investment and upgrading in rail than we would have done. A lot of people, I think, have never been convinced of the case for breaking up the railways. I'm quite interested from Matthew, you're talking quite a lot about the brand of Great British Railways, but what exactly does that brand cover? I'm not totally clear from that. Do the passenger service operators still have their own brands like Great Western or LNER or whatever that I've just been travelling around on? I'm not quite sure quite what I get for Great British Rail. And I think the big acid question in all of this, and I'm not sure whether Matthew thinks they've provided the answer, is one of the sort of worst examples of the problems that we've had in the railways was the Northern Rail timetable fiasco that seemed to run for months and months with loads of blame being hurled around, but absolutely nobody taking any responsibility or indeed stepping up to try and sort things. And I'm very intrigued from Matthew is if that, you know, does the existence of Great British Rail mean this will never happen again? Or does it mean that if it did happen, that it's very clear that it's GBR's role to sort it? So will this actually, you know, offer a visible difference to rail consumers? Because I think that's the test that people will want to apply.
Yeah. Matthew, what do you reckon?
Yeah, thanks, Jill. I think on your second question, it should make it less likely that there's a timetabling fiasco just because the timetables are being controlled centrally by GBR. If there was one, it would also clearly be GBR's problem to solve. So in theory, it should help with that. I think your first question about the branding of the service is in a way more difficult because that's not entirely clear just yet. The government has said it wants a clear GBR branding to be visible to the consumer when they're buying tickets and using the services. And possibly in England, you'll see that on the trains, maybe even more prominently than the branding of the train operating companies. I think it raises a really interesting question in the devolved administrations, though, in Wales and in Scotland. So is there a continuation of the ScotRail brand alongside GBR? And how is that going to look? Because it seems very unlikely that the Scottish government would want to subordinate the ScotRail branding to GBR branding in that context. But the government does want to be able to present a coherent offer across Great Britain.
Okay, fascinating details there. Sarah, can I just bring you in on this? Failing franchises, you know, rows about incomprehensible tickets, fares rising. Is this very British or do you have something the same in Australia?
I have to say, rail is definitely one area that comparisons between Australia and the UK are not particularly helpful. Australia, as we all know, is a vast but sparsely populated continent. Australians could really only dream of the kind of frequency of intercity rail services and the speed at which they travel in the UK. It just doesn't really stack up in the Australian context. That doesn't mean we don't have an appetite for rail stories, though, or rail TV shows. Speaking of trade between Australia and the UK, I have to confess that I thought Michael Portillo was a colourfully dressed train enthusiast long before I realised he was actually a politician.
Jill, you've been writing a lot about net zero. Where does this fit in with the government's plans to try and get our carbon emissions down?
Well, the government needs a functioning railway because the alternative to many people to rail is to use their car. Of course, the government has big ambitions that cars cease to use the internal combustion engine and we have a ban on sales of new ICE cars by 2030. But you have loads of other reasons why you'd actually prefer people to be travelling on rail. And that's why I think some of the things that Matthew was talking about is really interesting. Does this improve the services? Does this, you know, allow fares to be competitive? One of the big complaints of rail commuters over the last decade is that we've seen fuel duty frozen year on year, while rail fares have relentlessly moved up. So the government has been giving a whole bunch of very perverse incentives. It has to be said that I think one interesting thing about this is the Department for Transport, for a very long time, I do think Grant Shapps' big contribution to net zero is that I think he's changing this, but certainly within government, when I was knocking around doing transport policy in number 10, the Department for Transport was the department for roads. It measured its success in terms of road building programmes rather than anything else. It had a very troubled relationship with British Rail. And people who are nostalgic for British Rail do show their age quite markedly. I think, because British Rail was not great. But I remember having a huge battle.
Yeah, perhaps their lack of memory as well.
Their lack of memory or their lack of lack of being around to remember it. Mm. But I do remember having an absolutely massive battle with the Department for Transport back in the mid-1990s when we were writing the UK's first post-Rio sustainable development strategy. And it was a time of rail privatisation, and I wanted to put in, from number 10, a sentence that said, rail passenger numbers might go up as a consequence of privatisation. And DfT said, no, absolutely no chance. Rail is in long-term secular decline. We won't even let you have a government document that says numbers might go up. What, of course, that was the inflection point at which rail passenger numbers started to go, until the pandemic, almost inexorably up. So I do think that this might signal a new relationship, if you like, between the DfT and modes of transport other than cars. And some of the other stuff Branch Ups has been doing on net zero suggests that he is very different to some of his predecessors as Transport Secretary in that respect.
Yeah, you put it very well. But at the core of this is going to be the finances, because the government might want more people on the rails and get this all working. But it does have to crack this financial problem. Well, I'm sure we're going to be doing a lot more on that, because the subject is not going away. If the rail companies were on this podcast, I'm sure they would say, look, passenger numbers have gone up and we've poured investment in, and the trains are much cleaner and all this kind of thing. But the consequence of that's still to be worked out, and a lot of people still unhappy. For listeners, Matthew's working on this as part of arm's length body, is that marvelous bit of jargon, which stands for fascinating collection of agencies and regulators and so on. And the pandemic has revealed an awful lot of government unease about dealing with these things. So much more to come on that. Okay, let's turn to our third subject, civil service reform, IFG staple, but a big week for it. Well, Tuesday was a big day. Anyway, just after the G7 wrapped up, 12 hours or so after the government nixed the hoped-for end of lockdown, Michael Gove, also known as the Minister for the Cabinet Office, chose that moment to set out his blueprint for government reform, after doing a big speech on that about a year ago. And there were all kinds of eye-catching pledges in that, including moving lots of civil servants out of London. But there was also a lot of detail in there on pay, performance, accountability, and so on, that we were very pleased to see. Sarah, 8 pages of text, 30 short action points. What's your reaction?
Muted, in a word, for me. I mean, there's a lot in there that's welcome. Roman, you've mentioned a few of the commitments. There are other things like training for ministers, an evaluation task force. I mean, these are all great things. And it was, overall tone was welcome and helps draw a line in the sand under the Cummings era of hard rain. But I think the tricky thing with any civil service reform, I mean, it's easy to set out the problem diagnosis and to express aspirations, but it's much harder to move the dial into tangible actions. And we're still waiting for that.
Matthew, what stood out for you?
Well, I think a couple of things, actually. One was the document really did double down on a view of the relation between the civil service and the private sector in terms of employment and recruitment. So saying, we want to bring people into the civil service and enable people to rotate out onto Conman, gain that experience. So prioritising skills transfer, if you like, over the risks of conflict of interest that can arise from that, and assuming that those risks can be managed. I thought that was not necessarily the wrong call at all, but interesting given the recent controversy over double jobbing in the civil service, and a clearer statement on it than I might have expected. The other thing I was just going to mention was in the shortest section of the report on partnerships. There's a really interesting kind of it's only mood music in this document. It doesn't go into detail, but about the relationship between ministers and the civil service, and how ministers and civil servants should work together in meetings and consider new models of joint accountability. And you could read that as, in the short term, a resetting of the climate following Dominic Cummings' departure. But it also could be quite an interesting opportunity to rethink the role of the civil service relative to ministers going forward, I think.
Jill, let me ask you this. It's gone for this very heavy-handed alliteration of people, performance, and partnerships. Matthew just mentioning partnerships there. and people, it's got lots of stuff about skills and so on. But particularly on the performance and the partnerships, the relation between ministers and officials, it's something that the IFG has written a lot about, and we've been pleading for more accountability and so on. But I was unconvinced that it had cracked these old problems. What was your take on it?
I'm absolutely with you on that, because I think it's clearly identified a lot of problems, but those problems have been identified and knocking around for a long time. I think the real question is, do they find a decent way of unlocking this sort of accountability fudge that basically is the heart of our system? Actually, Michael Gove...
Just on that, Jill, what do you mean by the accountability fudge?
I mean the accountability fudge, which I think is a sort of implicit deal between ministers and civil servants, if you like, almost against the public interest, which is civil servants don't say out loud that what you, a minister, want to do is very difficult to deliver, very unlikely to work, etc., and frankly, quite unrealistic in many ways. They accept your sort of aspiration, whether it's to get universal credit up and running within 5 years or that your massive health reforms will deliver a much better health service for patients, things like that. They sort of, you know, let you have the political bandwidth and space to go with your political hunches, if you like. But equally, when your plans don't deliver as you expect, or as you might have hoped, to the fullest extent, you as a civil servant aren't held personally accountable and responsible for that failure. Michael Gove, actually, I put a question this at the launch event where Michael Gove was speaking. It was a hybrid event, so some of us could pose questions online. So Nick Herbert put my question to Michael Gove, which was whether he was planning to undo this sort of pact between ministers and civil servants and actually wanted civil servants to stand up much more to ministers and say, no, your idea is undeliverable, it's badly founded. And he gave a one-word answer, which was yes. And there is quite a lot in this reform report about looking again at the system of ministerial directions. Francis Maude, his predecessor in the Cabinet Office, who led civil service reform back in the coalition government, used to say that he wanted civil servants to request directions more often. A lot of useful stuff, I thought, some of the stuff in the evaluation task force, very interesting. This is something we toyed at in recommending in a 2011 Institute for Government report about whether an independent sort of evaluation task force would help departments do this more rigorously. I think that'd be very, very interesting if they really do embark about that. I have to say, I thought the government identified an issue on what exactly am I accountable for? You know, I remember I was the public service agreement senior responsible owner of DEFRA's, that's Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, PSA1, which was to deliver sustainable development at home and abroad as measured by progress on 15 headline indicators, which included things like numbers of burglaries. Frankly, if I thought my pay or my job tenure was going to depend on delivering all of that, I would never have taken the job. And I actually came back into government from outside to do the job because I was very enthusiastic about doing it.
The point you're making there is then about how starry and unrealistic some of these targets and goals are, and so people can't be held accountable for them.
I think if you go into a thing where ministers want deeply aspirational goals and objectives, you can't then hold civil servants accountable in the way that you might a sort of much easier, much more obvious, you know, delivery target. So I think, you know, I think IFG's put out a report this week on target setting. I think how on earth do you set proper targets, proper tasks is crucial to making this new accountability deal work. And are ministers really, really up for civil servants who challenge some of their fundamental premises? And I think that's the unspoken background lack of self-awareness in this document, that a lot of civil servants who've worked with these ministers over the last 4 or 5 years will say, actually, you know, are these ministers really, really interested in the best evidence? Are they really interested in putting up rigorous tests of whether their policies work?
Well, those are very good points. And I think it's weak as well on ministers' own accountability. As you said, they can frame these great ambitious things and try and hold civil servants to task for them, but there's a question of how they're going to be held to task them. Matthew, do you have any thoughts? And I'm thinking particularly of your Treasury past, and the Treasury's wrestled with these notions of performance and how to hold people to account and what public value means and this kind of thing. Do you think it's made any progress on this?
I don't think this document takes those debates forward. It reads in a very sort of manifesto-like way almost. For me, those are questions of detail. They matter, but there's a lot of work to do to tease them out, I think, following this publication.
And Sarah, you've looked at things like some of the government's decisions in coronavirus and so on, and this document does say, look, we're trying to take stock of the successes and the failures during this past extraordinary year and what it's told us all about government. Are there any thoughts that leap out for you from it?
I mean, I think I have to agree with Jill and Matthew on a lot of this. Certainly, I think it's commendable that the government has, as you said, Bronwyn, stopped to take stock of what's worked well and what hasn't worked well. But I think if you look back at the history of civil service reform, it's pretty good at the problem diagnosis. And the problem diagnosis tends to be relatively uncontroversial. So Michael Gove in his speech outlined some of the things that have worked well and some of the things that haven't. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find people that would disagree with that. I think what we consistently see that the civil service and ministers find more difficult is to translate that problem diagnosis into implementable action that actually works on the ground. So I think that's what personally, I welcome, everything that has been said. I mean, by and large, it's very sensible, but, the jury's still out onto whether it's actually going to make a tangible difference. I think, too, is it's very ambitious in its scope and what they want to achieve within this calendar year. I think if you look back at some of the big civil service reforms that have either stuck or been really successful, there have been times when government's only trying to do one or two things at once in that area, whereas when you look at what's in this document, it's like a gigantic shopping list of things, and it just makes you skeptical about actually is government going to have the bandwidth to achieve all these things while they're dealing with the aftermath of a pandemic and trying to achieve leveling up. And
that is a very good point, and it is, as I said, basically a year on from Michael Gove giving a very similar speech saying we need to do something about the structure of government, and some things have changed in that year, but I'm sure not as much as they wanted. And with that, that's it for this edition of Inside Briefing. So my huge thanks to Jill Rutter, James Kane, Matthew Gill and Sarah Nixon. And if you enjoyed this podcast, then do head to IFG Live, our sister podcast channel. We've got a special extended one on the government's civil service reform plans that we've just been talking about. And you can also listen to my discussion on what global Britain really means with Peter Ricketts and Peter Westmacott, two very distinguished former diplomats. Listen at Acast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and do leave us a review. We welcome declarations of podcast reform. Remember to check out all our work at instituteforgovernment.org.uk. You can find Matthew's fascinating paper on the rail reforms there, and a piece co-authored by me on these civil service reform plans. Thanks for listening. Somehow we've managed a whole podcast without even mentioning the football, but I wonder who the Prime Minister will support when England play Scotland on Friday. Enjoy the game.